Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. In keeping with the Buddha's encouragement to ensure that these teachings are freely offered to all, we do not have any set dues or fees associated with any of our classes or media. In an effort to sustain our ability to do so, we ask that you contribute via our website at againstthestreamnashville.com by clicking the Donate tab, or via the mobile app Venmo by sending a donation to the username at ATS Nashville. Enjoy. On Sunday nights, I usually give what's called a Dharma talk, which is basically, it's me speaking for a little bit of time on a theme of what the Buddha taught about this thing called the Dharma. And the Dharma is really, it's a collection of three baskets of teaching. One is aimed at looking at our, they call it ethics, or you know, living in a way that is in line with our values and integrity. So living with attention in our speech and how we communicate and how we live through our behavior in the world and how we work and the ways that we make money and engage with our society. Buddhism's a very engaged practice. And so looking at not only just this kind of like sitting down quietly and meditating, but also how do we bring interest and curiosity to our day-to-day lives in the world, especially as non-monks, right? We're not, I don't think we have any Buddhist monks in here tonight. So we've got to emphasize a lot this kind of foundational part of the Buddhist teaching, sila, ethics, integrity. And then there's also the basket of teachings that's aimed at mental training, mindfulness, the development of awareness for the purpose of clarity, seeing clearly into our often unconscious motivations, you know, the things that start our behavior are our thoughts. And so our thoughts, just like our behaviors, can become conditioned and we get better at whatever we do through our behavior. We also condition our thoughts. And so we need to look into the mind and say, what am I thinking about all day long? How do I view my place in the world? How do I view the experiences that I come into contact with throughout the day? We got to look into our own mind and look at our motivations, which are often, not always, but a lot of the ways that I act in the world are reactive. I just kind of do it out of habit. So mindfulness helps us to really kind of bring that attention and curiosity into the mind. And the development of these emotional qualities of compassion and kindness and appreciation or gratitude. You know, that these are things that I feel like if I was to just sit back, I would say, yeah, I believe in those things. I believe in compassion. I believe in gratitude and kindness. Those sound good to me. But, you know, we've got to really train and develop. Like, what does compassion look like in this moment? Because the thing that I've noticed is compassion is very variable. It changes depending upon the conditions I'm in. And so really bearing in mind, this word in Pali Sanskrit, anupasati, means to repeatedly look at. Repeatedly look at these qualities. What's the compassionate response right now? So we develop ethics and our integrity, living with integrity. We also develop and train the mind in awareness and clarity of mind, and also in responsiveness, this kind of emotional, heartfelt quality. And the purpose of the Buddhist teaching is to practice and train in these ways for the development of wisdom, insight. That as we stay interested in each moments of experience, more or less, throughout the day, as we bring more interest into moments of experience throughout the day, we start to see more with more clarity into how we act and react. We start to see in more clarity in which ways our values manifest in our speech, in our action, and in work. We start to see with more clarity in what compassion looks like given certain circumstances and situations. We start to develop our own wisdom. And the thing that's really hard to divorce from other, you know, especially kind of this Western frame or the way that Judeo-Christianity has come down into our culture, is that there's not really this list of wisdom that we need to abide by. There's not any really commandments. There's not any really idea of sinfulness or righteousness or right and wrong. It's not this kind of moral coding that we often find ourselves in. But Buddhism is more about what in this moments of experience is skillful and leads towards more less stress and suffering for myself and others. And what in this moments of experience do I often do or act or speak or behave that causes stress and suffering for myself and others. And so the thing that's hard about this is that it means that we have to have quite a degree of accountability. Yeah, because I'm not accountable, this is just my personal opinion, I'm not accountable to this idea that in the afterlife this is going to happen or that's going to happen. The Buddha wouldn't engage in those conversations, not because he said they're bad, but he said because it's not what he was interested in. Sure, there may be a heaven, there may be a hell, you may get reborn, who knows? And he said, who really cares? What are you doing right now? What's happening right now? Bringing interest and cooperation into this moments of experience. And so we need to have some accountability. It's hard to, you know, sort through the jungle, so to speak. The Buddha calls it the thicket of views. All of the views of how I should be or how I shouldn't be, or what's helpful and what's useful and what's harmful. How do we know? So this is the Dharma, and this is really in a lot of ways the point of the Dharma talk, is to talk about some practical, or really what the Buddha calls skillful means for working with the conditions of our lives. How do we deal with loss and relationships? How do we deal with what's effective communication? What's nonviolent communication? What's engaged Buddhism on a level of activism? What is mindfulness? How do I observe my mind? What is compassion look like? And so this is the purpose of the Dharma talk, is just to look and to invite some reflection around these things. And tonight I wanted to speak on a bit of an abstract topic, as I can do sometimes, on this theme of going from home into homelessness, which is a very big metaphor throughout the early Buddhist discourses. They call this going forth. Going forth from home into homelessness. This is, in the West, our idea of home is, I should say, it doesn't sound like something I would want to do. I don't want to go from home into homelessness. That doesn't sound like, I don't understand how that could be useful, just hearing that phrase. Because in the West, we have this idea that home is this place of safety, it's a place of shelter, it's where we find our family. It's kind of our refuge. Like, when I work and I come back home. When I go on vacation, I look forward to coming home, right? So why would I want to, you know, we even have these colloquialisms, these no place like home, or home is where the heart is, right? So it's a little bit of a strange metaphor. Why would I want to then leave that? But we have to look at, like, the Buddha's perspective was 2,600 years ago, living in a culture and a society where leaving home was a metaphor for living a life as a spiritual seeker. There were these people called spiritual mendicants who had given up their home and their responsibilities in the world to try to find something that was of deeper purpose and meaning in life. And in the Buddha's day and age, in that culture, in that society, he lived in what they call the Brahminic culture, which is where Hinduism came from. And the Brahminic culture was one that had a lot of social stratification, kind of like what we have today, a big divide in wealthy and poor. But during the time of the Buddha, it was something that you were born into. It was something that was spoken of and talked about as, this is just the way things are. When you're born into a position in society, into a caste. Right, and that your job was to fulfill what they call ritta, or an order. So by doing the duty of your caste, if you were the merchant and you went into the market and you sold things, you were fulfilling a greater order. And you may recognize this word. The greater order was for the purpose of developing what they call suwastika. And suwastika meant the good life. And so we can see where the same idea was taken later on in this kind of oppressive sense of that there's an order to things and that each of us have to fulfill and we have to kind of just abide by the order or the social norms that are placed on you. And the Buddha and many other people, not just the Buddha, rebelled against this idea. And this is what it meant to go from home into homelessness. It meant to leave this place of conditioning of the ideals and expectations that the society had placed on people in search of something that was deeper. Deeper than just, as we would say in the West, maybe making a living. You want to make a living. It's an interesting term if I think about it. Why? If I'm going to be here for a limited amount of time, why do I want to just make a living? What's the value in making a living? Sure, there's value. Making a living means supporting a family. So there's value there. That's a deeper meaning and purpose to making a living. Right? But there's this kind of leaving home is this being willing to kind of question the expectations and the values that are placed upon us by our families, by our schools, by our social systems, and by our own relentless, tyrannical mind, which we'll talk about. And so they called the Buddha, theologians called the Buddha the rebel saint, because he was a rebel in this way. He left that system, that way of operating that was very oppressive. And he said, there's got to be something more than just making a living. There's got to be something more than just being in my caste and doing what my duty is. And I think in some way, all of us have this interest. I think we wouldn't come out here tonight if we didn't have some type of interest in, oh, what is this about? This Buddhist meditation center or mindfulness? Or there's got to be some benefit to this. So going forth this in this metaphor, this first metaphor, I would say going forth from home to homelessness, the home represents living a life based upon the messages and demands we get from the world. And leaving home means living a life of deeper examination and exploration of what's truly liberating and meaningful in one's life instead of just what society tells us is liberating and meaningful. And so I don't know if you've noticed, but there are a lot of like inner voices that I have that come from other people. You know, expectations that I put on myself for productivity, of how productive I'm supposed to be. One of the biggest ones, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, is this kind of mind that has this linear map that at a certain age I should be at a certain place. Right? Do you notice this in your mind? I'm 30 years old, I'm supposed to have what? Family, a kid, two kids, two and a half kids, a white picket fence. Maybe that's your version or maybe not, but I think we all have this mind that projects, that has this sense that there's supposed to be some other life that we're living. And this is precisely what the Buddha kept pointing towards, is this part of our mind that keeps telling us that there's some other life that's not this life, that there's some other place or person or people that I should be with, or things I should be doing that's different than the way that I am right now. And what I notice about my mind as I continue to practice is this part of my mind never gives up. I never get there. I never get to that place. And my mind keeps telling me that that's the strategy, is that if you can just get the right partner, God, you've been single for so long. You can't seem to do the dating thing right. Or if you could just get out of this relationship. You've been in this relationship so long, right? It's like a damned if you do, damned if you don't. The mind is so unsatisfied. And a lot of this, in the part that I'm pointing to right now, sure, some of this comes from our kind of internal reinforcement. But a lot of these messages came from really early on. And they were passed down through society, and they were passed down through our parents. And so I want to talk a little bit about this, and how do we look at this, like, going forth, this idea of dropping those expectations and external demands, those external pressures. How do we do that in a skillful way? And so one Buddhist scholar says that going forth is the act of taking personal responsibility for oneself and one's development independent of the views and conventions of the society in which one belongs. In this terminology, going forth is the act whereby the individual separates herself from the group being the various overlapping collectives to which human beings belong and which are organized for their survival, exacting subservience to norms and customs as the price of protection and aid. Going forth from the group is therefore a key step in spiritual life, since it is only as an individual that one can develop on the path. Going forth does not, however, mean hostility to the group, merely that one is not or is less and less bound by its norms and customs. So that's an important distinction. What we mean here is not that we are what I call rebellious for the sake of rebelliousness. And this is something that I found, at least for myself, taking refuge in at a young age. There's a guy named Erickson that studies lifespan development, and he talks about this role in adolescence that they call identity formation, which is where you oppose the values of your own family, your parents, and pressures or expectations that were put on you at a young age. So you have to actually oppose those values to go explore the world to find your own identity. So this is why teenagers tend to be rebellious. They do things that I've heard people say, if you want your kid to be a good kid, just be a bad parent, right? It's like this kind of opposing or this rebelliousness, you know, which is a going forth, or it's a kind of going forth for the sole purpose of opposition rather than liberation. And so what I'm talking about here is that, you know, the Buddha was solution focused. You know, he wanted to encourage us to discern what's unskillful and then practice what's skillful. How do we know what's unjust, or how do we know what pressures from our society and culture are unattainable, are oppressive, are unhelpful, or painful? And how do we discern that without having to just rebel for the sake of rebelling, oppose for the sake of opposing, to know injustice but to look for liberation? So I'll try to kind of break this down a little bit. What I mean by rebelliousness for the sake of rebelliousness, it's when, you know, oftentimes we separate from groups. Like, maybe you can just put it in a simple form of like our friend groups because of experiences of betrayal, or when we've been ostracized or we've been harmed. And so there's this kind of like vengefulness to that hurt or that pain. And the reason why I talk about this is, like, if we look into politics, right, this divisiveness in our political worldview, is that in everything, I like to say, one of the things that we can reflect on in the Dharma is that for every one thing that's true, something else is also true. So what that means to me is that, like, there's divisiveness in our politics because there's divisiveness in how we have policies and how we tend to the people in our country. It has to be. It has to be that the reason why we're so divided is because there's something that we're not tending to that needs to be tended to. But the division is enhanced through this kind of wounding, that you hurt me, you hurt me, and we become identified with our wounding and we stay in our wounding. And we do this in other experiences of our life for people in this room that may have had to separate themselves or distance themselves from their families. You know, and this kind of like idea we practice in Buddhism of forgiveness, of how do we learn to let someone back into our heart but not having to let them back into our home? How do we learn how to deal with the wounding of the group? Where do our political ideals even start from? If you reflect for a second, for me it was in high school. And there was a group of people that I was identified with that had these ideals. And there was the other group of people that were the group of people that often ostracized me and hurt me and wounded me and that I didn't feel I belonged with, the expectations. And so we've got to look at, like, in this core principle in Buddhism is how do we get out of the shadow of separateness, the sense of separation, and find connection. And find a connection that doesn't mean we let the hurt or the pain or the, you know, abuse, for lack of a better word, back into our lives. I think this is at the world stage what we have to learn how to do. How do we solve this problem? How do we find solution when we are so divided? And if we're not divided, why does it appear we're so divided? So going forth is the act of taking responsibility for oneself and one's development independent of the views and conventions of society in which one belongs. Where do we find the inner strength and encouragement and urgency to do this exploration ourselves, to find a way of living a life that's meaningful? And what does that mean for us? What's a life worth living? There's this exercise that I do with some of my therapy clients. They call it a life worth living. And you diagram and you put up on the board all of these different values and all of our different arenas of life, like work and family, relationships, finances. And we have to learn how to kind of parse out which of these values come from external forces that don't really serve me, that are pressures, and which of these values do I actually feel I connect with and that I relate to and I want to live by. The Buddha is really just interested in teaching us how to explore our own life, to find a way at looking into our values and to living with those values, because when we live outside of our values, we live in suffering. And so this is what I call rebelliousness for the sake of freedom. To set one's mind into questioning, am I living the life I think I'm supposed to be living, or am I living a life worth living? That's just a simple way, I think, to put all of this. Am I living the life that I think I'm supposed to be living, or am I living a life worth living? And what is a life worth living? Because there's, you know, Mary Oliver says, I think I said this at the end of my last Dharma talk, she says, what are we going to do with this one wild and precious life? One of the reflections in the Buddha's Dharma is to reflect on death, and not for the purpose of this morbid, like, emo, goth, like, nihilistic worldview, but for the purpose of actually bringing more wakefulness into our life. I had lunch with a friend of mine today. He's not a Buddhist. I think everyone's kind of a Buddhist, even if they're not a Buddhist. But he was saying about how he woke up this morning and started crying because, this guy is not the type of guy you would think would share this. But he said, I woke up this morning, I looked at my dog, and I saw how gray my dog's hair was, and I just started crying, like knowing how temporary his life was. And like he had this moment of fear, like wrestling with this, like, why would I even have a dog if I just know that I'm more likely to outlive it? Like, why would I put myself through that? And to connect means to risk separation. This is one of the truths in the Buddha's Dharma, is that to be alive means to lose and to gain, to experience joy and beauty and also tragedy and sorrow. So living a life worth living means living a life that includes all of these things and stops banishing or thinking that I'm supposed to have some other life that's free of these things. That I'm supposed to get to the place finally where I'm going to have the right partner and the right job and the right amount of money, because it's never coming. And turning this on its head can be a scary endeavor. And it can create what the Buddha called samvega, which means spiritual urgency, which means an urgency to do something different. And the thing that I want to do with this is not to mystify it or make it like a Buddhist thing. We've all had moments of experience like this where you wake up and you're like, oh shit, why am I doing this thing that I'm doing? I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do something different. It becomes urgent. This is rebelliousness for the sake of freedom. This is going against the stream. So we can look some practical ways. We can look at the comparing mind. You know, social norms, like I said, around age. What are you supposed to be doing based upon what age you are? Just thinking, that would be a really fun thought experience. It's like sitting around, if we had enough time, and sharing, like, what age are you and what do you think you should be doing based upon what age you're at? I think what it would do is probably make us all laugh, and we would probably feel pretty ridiculous about the whole thing. The comparing mind, you know, our social expectations of productivity. You ever feel like you're not productive enough in this Western world where we value more than anything productivity and work? You know, what are we working for? What are we... All of this karma, this karma just means action. All of this action, what is it generating? It's generating a lot of, and I hate to do it because it's easy to turn this off, but it's generating a lot of capital. It's generating a lot of just shit. We're just generating stuff for other people to generate more stuff, to generate stuff, to generate more stuff. And we deplete our environment's resources, and we deplete our time spent with our family and loved ones, and we're just generating. And so to be alive means we have to generate shit. Like, we can't get out of that. What I'm not saying, but maybe what I could be saying, if it really sits with you, but I'm not saying go be a monk and leave the world and abandon your family and go, you know, like start a monastery in the forest somewhere, unless you really want to do that. But what I am saying is, how do we find, you know, more of a meaningful way of doing the work? What if I looked at my job, not at going in and I'm a data entryist, and I go and I enter the data and I enter the data and I enter the data, or I send the email, or I'm the communications person. Instead, what if it's like I go there and I get to be with this person, this coworker, and I get to listen to them today, and I get to like hear their struggle, and I get to support them, or, you know, I get to be a reliable part of a team. So it's all about our perception, really. Sure, some of it's in our actual action, but a lot of it's just in how we bring intention into our life. Rebelliousness for the sake of freedom, also looking at, you know, social expectations based upon things that we're born into, genders we're born into, country we're born into, races we're born into. You know, you may notice that the world has already kind of identified you a place. It definitely is harder for people that are prescribed a place to break out of that place. When they do something different, it shocks us and we get scared, or it brings into question everything we knew about, for example, gender. You see a transgender person, you say, oh, that's not normal. Why is that not normal? It's because it's something that maybe you're not familiar with, or you haven't seen or heard about. You know, it's not, you know, so what happens is when we start to break out of the box of what's been prescribed to us, we start to confront our own fear. And so the paradox here, you know, the deeper meaning of going forth is I should say, on the surface, it's maybe looking at our societal pressures or our family pressures. The deeper meaning is this. It's leaving what is familiar for what's unknown. A big part of the Dharma, leaving what's familiar for what's unknown. And this idea of going forth from home to homelessness, home is what's familiar. The problem with home is that it's limiting. The problem with what's familiar in your life is that it feels safe because we know it. But to leave it means to have to embrace the unknown. So this is the paradox. Familiarity provides safety, but familiarity also creates limits. Unfamiliarity is insecure, but unfamiliarity also has less limits. And so when we look into the mind, when we bring this internal mindfulness, looking into the mind, we want to look at what we call perceptual bias, that we see things based upon our perception. The mind names and labels things. And it does that for a very important reason. Like, I know that that's a chair. And I know that that's a chair, so I know I can sit in a chair because I learned, I don't remember when, but at some point I learned what a chair was because other people were sitting in a chair and I learned, okay, that's something you sit in. So we need perception. Perception is just the process whereby we recognize experience. It's a chair, that's my friend David. I like David. I know David. David's been coming a while. He's my friend. That's perception. This is a bell. At the end of the meditation, I'm going to hit the bell. And your perception of the bell is that when you hear that bell, you know that the end of the meditation probably is here, right? Because I hit the bell. Now, here's the problem with perception, is that when we don't bring awareness to how we name things, we get stuck in inaccurate perceptions of experience. And when we inaccurately perceive our experience, we react to our inaccurate perceptions. I'll give you a really clear example of this, distortion of perception. When I went to Anna retreat 2 years ago, actually in May, and it was a month retreat, silent retreat, and I was at a place called Vallecitos, which is in New Mexico. And in New Mexico, at Vallecitos, it's in the middle of the Carson National Forest, and there's nothing around for like miles. There's no one other than the people that are on the retreat. It's one of the most wild experiences I've ever been in. And during the retreat, 2-3 weeks into the retreat, you know, you haven't really talked to anyone other than in the interview period. You're really practicing mindfulness all day long. I was in the middle of the forest, way out, far from anyone else, and I was doing walking meditation in this big field. And while I was doing walking meditation, I was focusing on the feeling of my feet, stepping. I was really trying to be present with the breeze on my skin. You know, my sight, noticing the sights around me, smelling the smells. And I was walking, and I turn around, and I see a wolf staring at me about 20 feet away. And I see, and this wolf is like fucking huge. This is terrifying, right? Because there's no one around. I haven't talked. I don't know what to do when you're confronted with a wolf. And in a moments of experience, I got so scared. I started thinking about like Bear Grylls and like the Survivor Man series. If you ever see that. I tried to like remember what you're supposed to do if you see like a wolf. And I was like, is this one of those situations like a bear where you play dead and you just act like you didn't see it? Or do you run away? Or do you like run at it? Like, what do I do? So I made the decision after a couple seconds, terrified, to start to slowly turn around and just to like slowly walk away from the wolf like I didn't see it. Like I was going to use the ignore it strategy. I was like, all right, I'm going to ignore the wolf. And I turned around and I started slowly walking. And this wolf, I could hear it. I mean, everything was like slowed down for me, right? I heard like the feeling of its feet like leaving the ground. And I could hear its breath. And it was coming right towards me, and I turned around, and it jumped up in the air at me. And then it licked my hand. And I like had this moment of confusion, and I was like, what just happened? And I stood there in disbelief, and these people come walking out of the woods whistling after their dog. Right? Now, here's the thing. It's like, for me, this may sound ridiculous, but like, I was on a retreat where there were no dogs. No retreatant brought their dogs. There were only like 25 people on this retreat, and then there was a monk, and I know he didn't have a dog. And then there's a cook, and the cook didn't have a dog because I saw the cook every day, and there are two retreat managers, and I never saw them with a dog. Right? So I had no reason to believe there would be a dog. But in this moment of experience, given that information, my past, which is what our perceptions are based on, past experience, I recognize this thing in front of me as a wolf. And so it's kind of a ridiculous story, but the way that this kind of affects us in the way that we get stuck in what's familiar is that the mind's job is to name experience. It's to name experience based upon past experience. And so when we name our present experience based on past experience, we react to new things based upon old information. And sometimes that's useful, and a lot of times it's not. I call this the problem of fixation, which is the habit of mind where we often unconsciously interact with and react to people, places, and things based upon past experiences and old information. And so an example of this is what I call identity imprisonment, when we unconsciously imprison people, places, or things to past experiences. So one way that Joseph Goldstein, a senior meditation teacher in this lineage, he says that the story of your mother is not your mother. Right? The story that we tell ourselves of people, places, and things is not the full story, is it? It's our story, and we have our story for important reasons a lot of time, but we limit, especially when we come into contact with people, this procedural memory that helps us to drive a car, for example. I get in a car, I don't want to have to think about or relearn every time I get in a car how to drive a car. When a person comes into the room, I don't think about the reason why I have the story about that person, do I? I just have the way of reacting to or relating to that person. Maybe based upon a limited experience. One of the things that happens with our perception, and the other side of the coin is this, I call it the big letdown. It's when we interact with a person, place, or thing, expecting that person to be the same as last time, but they've changed. Like, even when you go to a restaurant, a person, place, or a thing, you order the same dish you got last time, and it doesn't quite taste the same, right? The big letdown. Or what we do in relationships is what they call the honeymoon phase of the relationship. They call it the first stage of intimacy, where you fall in love with your projection or your perception of the person based upon limited information. Well, they're hot. They laugh at what I say. They seem to like me. We like the same music. We fall in love. We fill in all the dots. Do you notice that perception does that? It's not your fault. The mind just does it. It fills in all the spaces. It idealizes or it vilifies the perception. And so one of the things that mindfulness really helps us to do to break out of the box or to move from home to homelessness, from the familiarity of our perceptions, is we have to have these rude awakenings, these moments where we start to own our part, to take responsibility for the stories the mind tells itself. And to say, you know what, Andrew, is that accurate? Is it fully accurate? Maybe a part of it's accurate, but is it 100% accurate? For every one thing that's true, something else is also true. What if I lived my life like that? What if when my mind got fixated on a person, place, or thing? Or what if I've been telling myself a story lately about who I am or how I'm doing or where I should be or how I'm not living up to expectations in myself or how other people aren't living up to my expectations? What if I was to say, well, you know what, maybe that's true, but maybe something else here is true too, and let's see if I can bring more interest into that. To let that be more unknown. I like to say to ask more questions than to have answers. This Dharma, this Buddha's path of practice, is all about asking questions. When we think we know, we suffer. When we say, I've got it, we suffer. When we have discernment, we say, well, I've got a piece of it. I think I know. I think I know when I hit the bell with this black part, it's going to make the soft sound. But if I haven't rang this bell before, I may be surprised. I may have to learn. And we want to be in a constant place of learning. We want to learn how to go forth from the home or the familiarity of our views and perceptions into more exploration. In Zen Buddhism, they call this the beginner's mind. Suzuki Roshi says, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert, there are few. I think in our Western world, we have this over-obsession with being right, with knowing the answer, with knowing about things instead of knowing things through experience. We value quantitative data over qualitative data, quantitative being the numbers over our experience. So what does it take to go forth? Again, it's an abstract metaphor, perhaps, but what it takes is it takes living with integrity, looking at our values, practicing wise speech and communication, making a commitment to non-harming for ourselves and others, including ourselves in that non-harming. It means having some accountability and some support. It means having forgiveness because we won't do it perfectly because there's no such thing as perfect in the first place. It means that we're just interested in waking up, whatever that looks like, whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim. It means that we take a commitment or make a commitment to practice mindfulness, active awareness throughout our days. And the thing I like to say about mindfulness is that you guys already, even if you've never practiced before tonight, you already have practiced mindfulness. The Buddha says it's an innate capacity of the mind, and neuroscience verifies this through this quality they call metacognition, which is an ability that we have. We can bring active awareness to our thoughts, feelings, and emotions. We can start to look at our motivations. We can start to look at our perceptual biases, how we fix, how we get lost in this expert. So this is a lot of different themes. We've got plenty of time. Something I like to say is that